and join a white fraternity. Street, who attended Morehouse, couldn't and wouldn't. In a way, Charlie thought as he tuned out the Canadian Governor General, Street conducted himself according to the stark black and white limitations of newspaper photographs. Powell thrived in his world of ethical and moral grays. He was on his second marriage to a Trinidadian singer and was rumored to live in a Long Island estate far from his Harlem district, enjoying a chauffeur-driven limousine of mysterious provenance. But beyond his fondness for drink, which was common to most of the veterans Charlie knew, Street was the picture of moral rectitude. When poker nights devolved into bawdy tales of grateful or desperate French or Filipino women, Street would shake his head and focus on the game. Unlike many of the other young veterans, including Charlie, Street had not added any post-war padding. Charlie couldn't imagine what it was like for Isaiah to have risked everything for his nation in war and then return home and be treated not just as a lower caste, but a potential menace. They had known each other for only 2 months, but Charlie's glances at the world through his friend's eyes had been revelatory. He was shocked by the disregard and hostility shown to Street by their fellow congressmen. Congressman Howard Smith of Virginia was one of the worst offenders, a man who would proudly proclaim his bigoted views from his perch on the Rules Committee. He automatically blocked any legislation that might help blacks, and often pompously declared that the good folk of the Commonwealth of Virginia had, quote, never accepted the colored race as a race of people who had equal intelligence to the white people of the South, unquote. He said this within yards of Powell and Street, and was applauded by his fellow Southern Democrats for doing so. After a particularly egregious display in which Judge Smith said that Truman's move to desegregate the army meant the United States would never again win a war, Charlie had tried to stand and register a protest. But Street, seated nearby, caught Charlie's eye and shook his head slightly, motioning for him to stay seated. That kind of thinking isn't going to be defeated by you taking on Judge Smith, Street said at the time, as they walked from the House floor. Remember what Branch Rickey said to Jackie Robinson, I'm looking for a ball player with guts enough not to fight back. Street and Charlie rarely talked about race, but it was the subtext of many policy debates, not to mention the culture. Charlie suspected that Street's stoicism came at a price. Just as Jackie Robinson did not naturally possess the patience of Job, just as Second Lieutenant Jackie Robinson had nearly been court-martialed in 1944 for refusing to move to the back of a military bus, Street seemed to struggle with the notion that a black man had to tolerate abuse, to be seen by whites as noble. India had gained its independence from the British, Street noted, but Gandhi had had to take 3 bullets to the chest. And an uppity Jackie Robinson would never have been voted Rookie of the Year, Street assured Charlie dryly. Charlie had come to conclude that Street was less visible but more radical than Powell. Congressman Powell embraced the employment opportunities offered by the new plant that General Kinetics wanted to build north of 125th Street. Perhaps he was truly a believer that any job was a good job. Perhaps he was beholden to General Kinetics in one way or another. Graft and corruption were certainly not new terrain for members of Congress of any race. Street seemed to be fighting more stealthily than Powell, while giving his enemies no ammunition. Who knows what Powell's reasoning is, Street suddenly whispered to Charlie, after making sure no one could overhear them, randomly picking up the conversation 15 minutes into the Canadian leader's droning speech. It's like trying to figure out why a lion takes a left, and it's irrelevant. I need you to see if there's some way you can quietly block permitting for the plant. What did you say about Mosstown? Mossville, Louisiana. Yes, that. I'll explain if this guy ever stops talking, Street whispered back. At last, the Canadian Governor General finished his speech to polite and sustained applause. After a few minutes, as Street and Charlie walked back to the House office building, Street elaborated. His wife had been raised in Mossville, and her family still lived in and around the town, in Calcasieu Parish, Louisiana. General Kinetics all but ran the parish, since it owned a number of plants there. Oil and gas refineries, factories that produced synthetic rubber, ammonia, magnesium, salt cake. Sounds like it would be booming. It is, Street agreed, a lucrative express train to the cemetery. After the plants had been operating for a few years, the scent of the air changed. No one who lived there noticed. The change came gradually. But those who visited from outside the parish would note the vinegary scent in their nostrils and the odd flavor in the backs of their throats. Tap water soon took on a smoky aftertaste. First to die were the mud lizards Renee and her brothers used to catch as children, Street said. the kids would find piles of their dead bodies on the shores of the bayou. Then came the herons and gulls and pelicans, bloated corpses just floating by the dozens. Then the livestock followed, chickens and cattle and horses. Then Renee's grandparents got sick. "These plants are booming now, Charlie," Street said as they reached the top of the stairs. "But that sound you hear isn't just the engine of capitalism. It's also a ticking time bomb. Might not go off for 20, 30, even 40 years, but it's going to go off." On the fourth floor, they prepared to go their separate ways. "I'll do whatever I can to help block the plant, Isaiah," Charlie said. "I don't know that I can do much, but I will try." The rest of his day was spent catching up with work he'd let fall by the wayside, returning calls and going over memos with Leopold. Senators Kefauver and Hendrickson's office both called this morning to see if we've arranged for a venue in Manhattan for the juvenile delinquency hearing, she said. She made no secret of her irritation. For weeks he'd declined to give her the go-ahead to do so. From behind his desk, Charlie bit his lower lip. Leopold stood before him, refusing to indulge his ambivalence. "Congressman, if you don't mind my saying so, you're going to end up doing this, so you might as well do it now and get the credit for it," she observed. "I'm going to exit this room and call the Foley Square Courthouse. Unless you physically block my path, this is what's going to happen." She left his office. Charlie remained in his seat, staring glumly at the closed door. The sun had already set by the time Charlie drove himself from Capitol Hill to Dent Place in Georgetown, parked, and walked up the steps of his brownstone. Turning the key and entering quietly so as not to wake Margaret, he was surprised to see the lights on in the foyer, the living room, and upstairs in the kitchen, where he found Margaret drinking tea at the kitchen table. He looked at his watch. It was after 8 p.m. "You're up late," he said with a smile, bending over to kiss her on the back of her head as he reached for the day's stack of letters. Margaret put her hand on top of his.
"I have two things to tell you."
"Okay," he said.
"Strongfellow just called from the hospital."
Charlie sensed what was coming.
"I'm really sorry, Charlie, but Mac didn't make it."
He stood frozen for a second.
"I'm so sorry, honey," Margaret said, now gripping his hand tightly.
He gave her hand a slight squeeze, then let it go. Suddenly he was a world away. Private Rodriguez had ripped off his gas mask, which was of no help. His nose was streaming mucus, his eyes were red, and tears ran down his cheeks. His body, pinned beneath the beam, began bouncing off the floor in convulsive spasms. Death was seizing Rodriguez and dragging him away, and there was nothing Charlie could do. The wall clock in the martyr's Georgetown kitchen delivered its tinny half-hour chime and returned Charlie to the present. He looked bleakly at Margaret, shaking his head in disbelief. Through the window, which was cracked open, came the sound of a swallow chirping. It was interrupted by the vroom of a car, its radio blasting one of the latest from Frank Sinatra. "A foggy day in London town. Had me low and it had me down." They sat in silence for 1 minute. 2 minutes. "How's the baby?" Charlie finally asked.
"She's good," Margaret said.
"She?"
"He, it, whatever."
She rubbed her stomach.
"He, she, it is great."
Charlie smiled sadly. "Good," he said, his gaze drifting out the darkened window.
"Honey?"
"I'm okay. I knew he wasn't going to make it."
"It's horrible. Just awful."
She stood and embraced him, but he patted her absently on the back and broke away. "I have to go to a meeting," he told her.
"A meeting? At 8:30 at night?"
"A reception. At the Mayflower."
"Really?"
she asked incredulously. "Believe me, it's the last thing I want to do." She stared at him as if she didn't recognize him. "Thanks for waiting up to tell me about Mac," he said. They were maybe 5 feet away from each other, but it felt like a mile. "What's the second thing?" he asked her. Through the fog of his grief, Charlie could sense Margaret wanting to say more. Her disappointment in him had lingered between them for weeks now. It was a conversation he would not be able to face tonight.
"Nothing," she said.
"Okay," Charlie said. He went upstairs, changed into his tux, came back down and grabbed his car keys from the counter. And without another word to his pregnant wife, he walked out of the room, down the stairs, and back onto their chilly Georgetown street. The Mayflower was a popular venue for D.C. events, and Charlie had already been there half a dozen times. Its first-floor bar, the Mayflower Lounge, was nicknamed the Snake Pit. On Friday nights, it became a rogues gallery of politicians, lobbyists, captains of industry,
and local women eager to make their acquaintance. Until tonight, Charlie hadn't known the hotel had a penthouse, and what he encountered when the elevator deposited him there made the snake pit look like a Boy Scout meeting. Standing in the foyer, facing two immense oak doors, Charlie could hear the muted blare of a trumpet and the deep roar of a party in full swing. A young red-headed woman, dressed like a chorus dancer at a burlesque show, greeted him with a smile and asked him to remove his shoes. "My shoes?" he asked.
"Yes, please, sir," she said. "Connie feels it helps everyone relax."
Charlie reluctantly surrendered his shoes and, feeling surprisingly disarmed by their loss, squared his shoulders as she opened the door, flashed a bright and possibly flirtatious smile at him, and ushered him inside. Chapter 14. Thursday, March 4th, 1954, evening. Mayflower Hotel, Washington, D.C. The immense room was dark and rich with a bouquet of sinful aromas, cigars and cigarettes and grain alcohol and fruity cocktails being enjoyed by a room full of older men and younger women. Thanks to D.C.'s restrictive 1899 Height of Buildings Act, the Mayflower stood as the tallest building in the neighborhood, so the ceiling-high windows offered revelers a clear panoramic view of the city at night, the illuminated Capitol building on the far left, the glorious White House straight ahead, the Washington Monument and Lincoln Memorial farther toward the horizon. A dozen or so beautiful waitresses, nubile was the word that sprang to Charlie's mind, glided around, tending to the men's drink and food and conversational needs. Charlie accepted a martini and made his way into the room.
"Je cherche un millionnaire avec de grands Cadillac cars," sang Eartha Kitt through the hi-fi speakers.
"I wish I knew French," said an unusually gregarious Chairman Carlin, sidling up to Charlie. "That Eartha Kitt is something else. She's singing, I'm looking for a millionaire with big Cadillacs," Charlie translated. He paused, took in more of the lyrics. "Mink coats, jewels up to the neck, you know? I think that's the gist."
"Sounds better when she says it," Carlin said, lighting a cigarette and flagging down a waitress.
"Darling, can I trouble you for another Glenfiddich single malt?"
She smiled and touched his cheek affectionately.
"Man, I do love Connie's parties," Carlin said, more to himself than to Charlie.
"All this just to thank us for helping him get cheap Mexican labor?"
Carlin shrugged. "He likes his braceros. I prefer to think of it as a demonstration of appreciation from a constituent, and with hotels all over the country, he's basically everyone's constituent." Abruptly, Carlin looked at Charlie with an expression close to a sneer, then walked away. Charlie looked around to see if someone other than himself had been the focus of that disdain. Nope. Such an odd man, Charlie thought. He stepped deeper into the throng. Members of the House and Senate mingled with business leaders and young women who were cocktail waitresses or guests. There was a slight undercurrent of carelessness, an atmosphere even freer than the snake pit 12 floors below them. They were safe. No journalists, no gossips, no wives, no one uninvited.
"I didn't know they let dog faces in here," Congressman Pat Sutton, the Navy man and Kefauver challenger, slapped Charlie on the back with more aggression than seemed necessary. Half of Charlie's martini spilled onto his pants and the thick oriental carpet.
"Hello, Pat," Charlie said, annoyed, surveying the damp damage below.
"Charlie, you tell your friend Kefauver that I am going to whip his ass."
Reeking of gin, Sutton wrapped the crook of his elbow around Charlie's neck and pulled him closer, then kissed the top of his head. Charlie concentrated on preserving what was left of his martini.
"Good luck to you," Charlie said. "Unseating an incumbent is tough for anyone, let alone in a primary, but what do I know? I'm new here."
"Oh, you know stuff, Charlie," Sutton said earnestly, mistaking Charlie's false modesty for legitimate humility.
"Your book was a great read."
"Thanks." Charlie seriously doubted that Sutton knew the book's title, much less that he had cracked its spine.
"Listen, have you really thought this through? Kefauver has a national following. Why not wait for a better moment? Why risk ending your trajectory so soon?"
Sutton snorted.
"Charlie, Kefauver isn't going to know what hit him. I'm getting tons of support from folks who want to send that pansy packing."
He pointed vaguely toward the crowd.
"You see that man with the waxed mustache? Made a killing when General Kinetics bought those defense contractors after the war. He told me I could travel the state using his helicopter. They're lining up to back me, and believe me, a lot of cash is going to come my way from Chicago. Estes made a lot of enemies there during his last crusade. He held up his tumbler in a salute, then poured the remaining whiskey down his throat and stumbled off. Information was ammunition in Washington, Charlie thought, and Sutton had just given him some that could be used against him. It was amazing how foolish, how reckless people in this town could be. The copious amounts of booze with which politicians regularly pickled themselves played a significant role in this, of course. He looked around the room, surveying the other guests. A leather-faced politician from out west, bearing more than a slight resemblance to the desert tortoises indigenous to his congressional district, sat on a cushiony sofa, his enormous gut protruding over his crotch. Charlie watched as he grabbed a passing waitress and pulled her onto what little lap could be found. She tried to laugh it off, but her eyes revealed her revulsion. "I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow," Sinatra sang over the suite's hi-fi system. Charlie walked to one of the immense windows and stood staring out at the White House, five blocks away. Should he tell Kefauver what Sutton told him? Saying cash would flow in from Chicago was essentially a confession that Sutton would find his campaign coffers filled by mobsters, still angry with Kefauver for his hearings against organized crime. Charlie was trying to ingratiate himself in this world, and Sutton had just sloppily handed him the coin of the realm. He had to consider his own motives. Why would he run to tell Kefauver about Sutton? But Blanche, when asked to share the Boschwitz dossier with Bob Kennedy. Just because Kefauver had been nice to him? What kind of principle was that?
"You seem like the kind of guy who thinks too much," came a flat voice with a Bronx accent.
Charlie turned around to see Roy Cohn, McCarthy's chief counsel on his committee. With dark and deep eye bags that belied his 27 years, and a crooked nose that made him look like he'd been punched in the face a few times, Cohn exuded a confidence that perplexed Charlie.
"Roy Cohn," the attorney said, putting out his hand to shake Charlie's.
Charlie greeted him, trying to keep a neutral expression that wouldn't betray what he thought of Cohn and McCarthy.
"Nice to meet you," he said reflexively. He could almost see Margaret's disapproving face hovering in the background.
"Charlie Martyr."
"I know your dad," Cohn said. "A good man. He gets it. He gets it."
In 46, as a favor to a Wisconsin power broker, Winston Martyr had hosted a fundraiser for McCarthy's first Senate race. When McCarthy was up for re-election in 52, 2 years after he launched his crusade against communists, real and imagined, Winston continued his support for him out of inertia more than anything else. Or so he had rationalized it to Charlie. Over Cohn's shoulder, Charlie noticed Senator Kennedy and Ambassador Lodge, opponents in a fierce U.S. Senate race 2 years before. They were smiling and warmly toasting each other with martini glasses. Bygones, Charlie supposed. A third man came up to Kennedy and Lodge.
"That's Joe Alsup," Cohn told Charlie, following his line of sight. "The columnist. You know him?"
"I know of him," said Charlie. A waitress approached them. Charlie and Cohn swapped their empty glasses for fresh and ice-cold dirty martinis.
"You might recall that Senator McCarthy called Alsup a queer in that letter to the Saturday Evening Post," Cohn remarked.
"I do," Charlie said, still focused on Kennedy, Lodge, and Alsup, who were now joined by a tall man with a mustache and round glasses, Central Intelligence Director Alan Dulles.
"Part of our campaign to remove perverts from the government," Cohn said. "Alsup is a queer, you know."
Charlie nodded and finished his martini, so cold it barely even had a flavor. He was supremely uninterested in Alsup's sexuality, and he couldn't help finding it odd that Cohn was pressing the issue, given the rumors he'd heard about the lawyer's own private life.
"They look like they're up to something," Charlie noted. "Maybe another assignment," Cohn hypothesized. "Alsup went to Laos a couple of years ago to do some work for Central Intelligence. Then last year, same thing in the Philippines."
"Alsup did work for Central Intelligence?" Charlie asked, stunned that a journalist would be secretly working for the government. Having first made his name covering the trial of the Lindbergh baby kidnapper and murderer, Bruno Hauptmann, Alsup was one of the most highly regarded newsmen of the day. He'd written a bestseller about FDR's attempts to pack the Supreme Court, and three times a week he and his brother Stuart wrote a widely read column for the New York Herald Tribune.
"Proudly," Cohn said, spitting as he talked, "if I may quote Mr. Alsup, the notion that a newspaperman doesn't have a duty to his country is perfect balls. He's a patriot and a pervert. A patriotic pervert."
Cohn laughed at his own remark. Charlie did not know what to say. Homosexuality was not something he gave much thought to, other than when he heard rumors about J. Edgar Hoover or Cohn himself.
The two men stood at the hub of the national security apparatus, so powerful that they thrived, despite Eisenhower's executive order from April 1953 that essentially banned homosexuals from the federal workforce, since they were regarded as susceptible to blackmail and were thus obvious security risks. You see, Charlie, there are the domestic political fights we Americans have with one another, and then there is the common struggle against the Reds, Cohn continued as if a microphone had been placed before him. The Communist Party is not a political party, it's a criminal conspiracy. Its object is the overthrow of the government of the United States by force and violence when the right time arises. The Communist Party's most important work until then is espionage on behalf of the Soviet Union. Don't tell me, let me guess, Charlie said, attempting to lighten the mood. You hold in your hand a list of 123 individuals in this room, known to be members of the Communist Party. Cohn's face twisted into something that seemed half smile, half snarl. Cute, he said. Charlie was done trying to be polite to a man who made his skin crawl. He looked away from Cohn. Nearby, four guests, two slick business types and two young women in tight sweaters, laughed uproariously. Senator Kennedy was on his way to the door. The old desert tortoise was helped up from his seat by the young woman whom he had snared earlier. Les Paul and Mary Ford's Vaya con Dios filled the air. Now the hacienda's dark, the town is sleeping, they sang. Now the time has come to part, the time for weeping. Vaya con Dios, my darling, Carlin bellowed from across the room, where he was sitting on a plush leather chair fit for a king and surrounded by hangers-on, his own personal court. Vaya con Dios, my love. One of the young women began mimicking a Mexican dance, raising her dress above her knees dramatically. Carlin's toadies began shouting, Ole, ole! Look at them celebrating how they're letting more spicks come into the country, Cohn said. No doubt with some Reds among them. Disgusting. Charlie didn't disagree with Cohn's estimation of Carlin and his court, but the ethnic slur shot a bolt of adrenaline and anxiety into his stomach. He hadn't known many Mexican-Americans in his life, except for Private First Class Rodriguez. I wish my old army buddy Manny Rodriguez were here, so you could say that to him, he finally said. Why isn't he? He's dead. Under your command, was he? Cohn said smoothly. He signaled a waitress for another drink. Look at the headlights on this one, he said, a little too enthusiastically, as the young woman approached. The Rubenesque waitress, barely staying within the confines of her outfit, handed highballs to Cohn and Charlie. Someone bumped into her and she jostled Charlie. Her long red hair swept across his neck and cheek, but she kept the drink tray steady. Arpège, Charlie said. By Lanvin. Huh? Said Cohn. Very impressive, said the redhead, a slight southern lilt in her voice. Charlie smiled. What are you talking about? Said Cohn. Arpège.
It's my perfume, she said. I didn't even put any on today.
I have an unusually keen sense of smell, Charlie said.
Wow, like a superhero, said the waitress. That must be quite a gift.
If this were a world where there were more of you than of him, Charlie said, motioning to Cohn, it might be. Evening, Roy, Bob Kennedy said, approaching them. Recognizing Charlie, he nodded. Congressman, he said. Charlie Martyr, Charlie said, not sure if Kennedy remembered his name. In Washington, Charlie had noticed, people tended to avoid names in case they got them wrong. They tended to say, nice to see you, instead of nice to meet you, in case they had met you before. New social rules for an egoistic town, where every monument and street was named for their predecessors. Right, of course, said Kennedy. We met you and your lovely wife at Martin's Tavern. I just heard you're working with Estes on the upcoming juvenile delinquency hearings. Cohn choked on his drink. It turned out he was laughing. You're part of those bullshit comic book hearings? He guffawed dramatically. Kennedy grinned and looked at Charlie apologetically. Charlie was not particularly amused. He'd had enough of Cohn's abrasive company by now. You were asking me about the commie simps in this room, Congressman, Cohn said. Well, they worry me more than Wonder Woman does. He took another swig of his drink and stared out the window. But none of them concern me as much as the commie simps over there in that big white building, Cohn said, motioning with his chin toward the White House. What must the world look like from that address? Must look upside down. Goddamn Ike protects the commies and fucks with Senator McCarthy. Cohn looked at Kennedy. He's terrified Joe will run for president, you know. Joe could beat him, too.
Joe McCarthy could beat President Eisenhower? Asked Charlie incredulously. Beat the smartest general we've had since Sherman?
Smart? MacArthur called Ike the best clerk he ever had.
And Ike said he studied drama under General McCarthy for 4 years.
Kennedy chuckled. Now, gentlemen.
MacArthur, said Charlie sarcastically, pretending to search the skies for a reminder of the general so ignominiously fired by Truman 3 years earlier.
The name rings a bell.
MacArthur is a great man, a patriot, said Cone. I'm sure you have a Medal of Honor under your shirt there.
No, said Charlie. Just some shrapnel. He finished the rest of his drink. Nothing like your paper cuts from the Battle of Torts 101. An awkward silence hung like a noose. Charlie had surprised even himself with that one. Liquid courage, he supposed.
Kennedy tried to break the tension. Why do you think Joe would be a good president, Roy? If Joe were president, the first thing he would do would be to end the Cold War, Cone said. He'd pick up the phone and call Joe Stalin and say, This is Joe McCarthy. I'm coming over tomorrow to talk about things. Meet me at the Moscow airport at 1 o'clock. When he arrived in Moscow, he would sit down with Stalin in a closed room. First, he'd tell a couple dirty jokes. Then he'd look Stalin right in the eye and say, Joe, what do you want? And Stalin would tell him. They would talk man to man, not like pansy diplomats. They'd find out what each of them wanted and settle their differences. But when Joe left, he'd tell Stalin, The first time I catch you breaking this agreement, I'll blow you and your whole goddamn country off the map.
Charlie turned to Kennedy. He can't honestly believe this rubbish, can he?
You little establishment punk, spat Cone. You think you know anything about defending this nation?
He looked at Kennedy.
Isn't this the same little shit whose daddy got him his seat, who was trying to fuck with the General Kinetics acquisition of Goodstone?
Charlie and Kennedy were both taken aback at Cone's outburst. It was delivered with the virulence of a cobra strike, drawing attention from nearby guests.
That's not quite how I would put it, Roy, Kennedy said, patting him on the back, trying to calm him. But yeah, Charlie tried to stop the funding for Goodstone. It had something to do with bad gas masks they made in the war that cost the life of one of your men. Right, Charlie?
That's right, said Charlie. Company made a cruddy product. Clear case of war profiteering.
Cone waved his arms as if he were washing a car with two sponges. Forest, he said. Then he started pointing at imaginary items in the air. Trees, he said.
Pretty glib talk about the death of an American soldier, Charlie said. Though, Bob, I guess that kind of sacrifice is not a subject Mr. Cone here could understand, especially these days when he's busy maligning the army.
You just don't get it, Cone said, shaking his head and taking another swig of his drink. Alexander Charleston, the CEO of Goodstone, is a patriot. Duncan Whitney, the CEO of General Kinetics, is a patriot. These are men who support Senator McCarthy's work and the work of his committee. They can see the forest for the trees. The Reds are about more than the loss of one Mexican private.
He wasn't Mexican, said Charlie. He was born in New York.
The Reds don't care about the loss of one soldier, Cone continued. One soldier? They slaughter millions. Are you defending that? I mean, you need to have a little respect for Senator McCarthy.
Charlie squinted, as if looking at Cone through an adjusted lens would make sense of him. I do have little respect for Senator McCarthy, he said.
Cone's eyes seemed to redden, turning bloodshot with his internal fury. Kennedy put his arm around Charlie. I think this conversation has come to its logical conclusion, he said. Charlie, why don't you go mingle, socialize for a while? I can't wait to see this little snot's face when McCarthy accepts the nomination in 2 years, Cone said. We'll make sure to put the New York delegation up front so the cameras don't miss you all crying.
Charlie polished off the rest of his drink and locked eyes with Cone. He handed his empty glass to Kennedy and slowly walked away.
Adios, amigo, Cone said.
Charlie paused but then decided to let it go. He made his way, stumbling somewhat, to the bar. He'd lost count of how many drinks he'd had by now. He wished Margaret were with him, or Street, even Strongfellow, a friendly face. Someone had dimmed the lights of the room even lower. A toxic cloud of cigar and cigarette smoke hovered over the crowd.
Oh, my papa, to me he was so wonderful, sang Eddie Fisher over the speakers. Oh, my papa, to me he was so good.
Charlie wobbled around the periphery of the room, taking in the scene as the guests marinated in free booze. An overweight senator from the Midwest had all but hijacked a waitress
and was voraciously wolfing down canapés from her hors d'oeuvre tray as if it were his kitchen table. A powerful house member, so old and shriveled he resembled a baked apple, slow danced with one of the cocktail waitresses, hands like talons edging their way down her hips. When the couple turned around, Charlie was surprised to see that her expression was nonchalant. Indeed, many of the women here seemed remarkably at ease among the powerful, drooling old men. At the far side of the room, four U.S. senators began singing Let Me Call You Sweetheart a cappella. Charlie, I wasn't sure if you were going to come, pregnant wife and all. Charlie turned around. It was Strongfellow, looking more urbane than ever, wearing a blue blazer over a turtleneck. He pivoted on his crutches, swung toward Charlie, and grabbed his hand in an enthusiastic hello. Strong, said Charlie, delighted to have some friendly company at last. What is this place, anyway? Some sort of club. It's kind of mysterious, Strongfellow said. Don't know much about it other than you find out more when they want you to find out more. Charlie looked around the room. Pretty august company. Bipartisan leaders of, well, everything. Vanderbilts and Rockefellers. Powerful, impressive men, plus you and me, he joked. Carlin told me to find you and bring you to the library, Strongfellow said. It's this way. Charlie followed Strongfellow along the outskirts of the room to two thick mahogany doors, which swung open to reveal a cocktail waitress, the same redhead from before. She smiled demurely at Charlie and held the door open for them. A hallway presented them with choices, a kitchen to the left, a library to the right, and who knew what straight ahead. This way, Strongfellow said, veering toward the library doorway, which was flanked by two small stone statues, a man and a woman, both holding fingers to their lips. Shh. Between them, a man in a dark suit with sharp cheekbones and a high and tight haircut stood, blocking their path. Do what thou wilt, Strongfellow said to him, and the man stepped to the side, letting them through. Charlie trailed behind his friend, wondering what the hell he had just said. Was it a password? And where he had heard it before. The library was smoky, the lighting low. One wall was occupied by floor-to-ceiling shelves packed with leather-bound books. The wall to Charlie's left was dominated by an enormous fireplace with an ornate marble mantelpiece on which had been carved the words, Hospis negare si potes quod offerat. Stranger, refuse if you can what we have to offer, Charlie translated to himself. Around the fireplace hung 12 stained glass images of various politicians and CEO types, each in an obscene pose with a naked woman. Given the medium, their identities were difficult to discern with precision, though they seemed to be depictions of specific individuals. One resembled Carlin, another Ambassador Joseph Kennedy. The one on the far end appeared to be FBI Director Hoover. The wall to the right was covered with portraits of U.S. presidents and women whom Charlie did not recognize. Women wearing plunging necklines and sultry expressions. In the center of the room, a half a dozen men played cards around a green baize-covered table, while others in various corners spoke in low tones over cigars and highballs. In his haze, before he knew what he was doing, Charlie was suddenly standing in the far-left corner of the room by Senator McCarthy and Duncan Whitney, the CEO of General Kinetics, whom Cohn had just extolled as a great patriot. The two men were sinking into immense red armchairs facing the center of the room on opposite sides of a small round accent table on which burned a thick white candle. Speak of the devil, McCarthy said dramatically to Whitney. Duncan, this is the congressman who made the stink about Goodstone. He smiled at his friend, then at Charlie, who was disarmed by McCarthy's almost palpable charisma. He recalled his father warning him that he would like the Wisconsin senator if he ever met him. Charlie had rolled his eyes at that, but now, in his presence, he could see what his dad had been talking about. Another scotch and another bicarbonate of soda, McCarthy said to a waitress fluttering by. And bring me a stick of butter if you can, with a fork. Charlie shot him a confused look at that, and the senator explained. It's helpful on a night like this. You should try it. You're the young man whose platoon had a gas mask a soldier couldn't operate properly, said Whitney, who bore a strong resemblance to affable everyman actor Fred McMurray. Genial face, twinkling eyes. It wasn't the soldier that was the problem, but yes, sir. I'm sorry to hear about that. The folks at Goodstone said they fixed the problem, but after this acquisition goes through, we're going to make doubly sure that never happens again. You're Winston's boy, said McCarthy, as if it were just dawning on him.
He held out his big, meaty catcher's mitt of a hand to shake Charlie's. So good to have you in Washington. I haven't spoken to your father in some time. Tell him I said hello. The waitress brought him a glass of scotch, and he downed it like a thirsty man at an oasis, emptying the tumbler in seconds. The waitress handed him the glass of bicarbonate of soda. He took a sip and handed it back to her. Anyway, where were we? He asked Whitney, pounding on his armrest. Oh, Murrow. Anyway, I don't care what he does. If you want to be against McCarthy, you got to be a communist or a cocksucker. He guffawed loudly, a deep, boisterous belly laugh that drew the attention of everyone in the room. Boy, he said to Charlie, we're on the most important skunk hunt ever. And look, I know my methods aren't refined, but you don't go skunk hunting in striped trousers and a tall hat while waving a lace handkerchief. He laughed hard at his own joke. Whitney tittered. Charlie observed McCarthy. The charm, the menace, the glint in his eyes that seemed to suggest that you were in on it with him and wasn't this fun. There was something about McCarthy that instantly conveyed to people that he liked and cared about them, Charlie could see, and something inside Charlie, he recognized, sought McCarthy's approval. It was a kind of twisted magic. McCarthy smiled as the waitress came back with a stick of butter on a plate, a fork, and a napkin, and he motioned for her to put it on the table next to him. Charlie, said Chairman Carlin from the corner of the room, where he was sitting with Davis LaMontagne and Strongfellow. Come join us. McCarthy and Whitney had resumed their conversation as if Charlie were no longer standing there, so he walked over, greeted the men, and assumed a space on the couch being made for him next to Carlin. LaMontagne's smile was friendlier than Charlie would have expected.
Nice to see you in the club, he said.
Charlie gave what he hoped was a noncommittal expression, still reeling from the bizarreness of meeting McCarthy and Whitney, and wondering again what he had unwittingly joined tonight. He gave a slight nod of his head toward two gentlemen seated in deep leather armchairs. One was Alan Dulles, director of Central Intelligence, the other a wrinkled old man with thick glasses and a face like a fist. Who's the guy with Dulles? Strongfellow peered at the man over his whiskey glass and shrugged.
Got me.
You two sure are freshmen, aren't you? LaMontagne said teasingly.
Strongfellow and Martyr, you are embarrassing me, exclaimed Carlin with mock outrage. That's Sam the Banana Man.
Charlie and Strongfellow looked at each other blankly.
Come on, guys. Sam's a Murray,
LaMontagne said.
The president of United Fruit Company?
He's only one of the most influential people in the world, Carlin said. United Fruit has banana plantations all over the Caribbean and Latin America. They helped fund our big push against the commies in Guatemala last year.
Yeah, the Dulles brothers have worked with the Banana Man for decades, added LaMontagne. They were on the payroll for years. They still work for them, essentially. The company's top lobbyist is married to Ike's personal secretary. Ambassador Lodge is a stockholder. It's all one giant fucking banana split.
Do what thou wilt, muttered Carlin, and the group laughed. Even Charlie, whose fascination with the ways of Washington often edged out his disgust. He felt a bit woozy and realized he was heading well past bombed. He hadn't been much of a drinker until they moved here, when he quickly adopted the habit, more out of circumstance than desire. There were always free drinks being offered to him in rooms packed with outwardly respectable elected officials, slowly getting embarrassingly soused. It wasn't that his previous life in academia was teetotaling. Indeed, the Columbia faculty had more than its share of drinkers. Rather, it was a matter of discretion. Boozing professors tended to keep their pre-sundown imbibing private, an occasional nip from a flask, wine during office hours. On and near Capitol Hill, however, fully stocked bars and professional workspaces were as common as any other pieces of furniture. They were right off the house chamber, in the conference rooms of law firms, next to the teletype machines in the offices of newspaper editors.
What the hell is this place? Charlie asked. Pornographic stained glass? And is that Senator McKeever in that one over there?
Just some harmless fun, LaMontagne said with a shrug.
Hey, Charlie.
Carlin put a beefy arm around Charlie's shoulder and leaned close to whisper in a boozy drawl.
Do you want to know a secret?
Sure.
Although at the moment, what Charlie wanted most was to get upwind of Carlin's 90-proof breath. Carlin pulled Charlie even closer.
I screwed you on Goodstone, he said,
a big, beaming smile exploding on his face, a fat finger landing on Charlie's lapel for emphasis. Charlie blinked.
LaMontagne and Strongfellow chuckled, though it wasn't clear if they were laughing at the news or the shocking way it had been delivered.
But I saw the bill, Charlie said. You struck out the provision.
That is true, Carlin said, now wagging his finger in the air, granting the point. But what you didn't see was a provision we added in a separate part of the bill, allocating the same amount for any subsidiaries of General Kinetics.
Which, as you may know, Charlie, Goodstone is about to become, said LaMontagne, a smug look on his face.
Charlie rocked back slightly in his seat. He felt as if he'd just been punched in the stomach.
Now, son, said Carlin, giving him a patronizing pat on the back. Don't take it so hard. You're not the first pretty young thing I've screwed this week, and you won't be the last.
Charlie felt a hand on his shoulder. Strongfellow was trying to console him.
The larger point, Charlie, is you're right. Goodstone fucked up, added LaMontagne. But these companies were rushing product for the war effort. No one was trying to kill anyone.
And the fight goes on, Charlie, said Carlin.
And the fight goes on, Strongfellow repeated.
Charlie felt deflated. An expert in the deal-making, debauchery, and duplicity of the Founding Fathers, he wasn't naive about politics. It could be vicious. And it was ever thus. Charlie had written a well-received article about how the ferocious and cruel attacks by John Quincy Adams' friends against Andrew Jackson's wife, Rachel, accusing her of bigamy, had all but certainly led to her death after the election of 1828. In a historical context, Carlin's maneuver wouldn't even be a footnote in an encyclopedia of chicanery. But no one had ever lied to Charlie's face like that before, much less relished the revelation of the deception. It enraged and humiliated him. The red-headed waitress appeared with her ubiquitous silver tray, this time bearing bottles and implements, as if she were about to assist in a surgical procedure.
Ah, Susanna, said Carlin. Thank you.
Absinthe? Asked LaMontagne. What's the occasion?
It's almost Friday, joked Carlin.
Susanna deposited the tray on a table and began an elaborate preparation. First, she held up a silver-slotted spoon. Then, with some pageantry, she displayed a sugar cube, as if it were a chunk of gold panned from a river. Then she delicately put the sugar cube on the spoon. She was joined by a second, wayfish waitress, who produced a delicate dark bottle and poured a green liquid into a glass, then put it in front of Charlie. Susanna placed the spoon with its sugar cube on top of the glass, and then used a syringe to slowly drip ice water onto the cube.
What ratio are you going with? Carlin asked her.
1 to 4, I think, she said.
Better make it 1 to 5, Carlin said. This is probably Charlie's first absinthe. Right, Charlie?
Charlie nodded. It was something that hadn't interested him or been readily available during his time in France. Clouds billowed in the glass as the drink took on a milky look, and Charlie began to smell its pungent licorice scent. He looked anxiously at Susanna.
This is how the French do it, Carlin said, and Susanna nodded.
Carlin and I normally go for the bohemian way of preparing it, said LaMontagne.
Carlin reached into Susanna's pouch, snatched a sugar cube, and popped it in his mouth.
The cubes are soaked in alcohol for bohemian, then set on fire. It's stronger that way. But you don't need it stronger for this first venture, said LaMontagne.
Charlie raised his glass to them, wondering why he was toasting the man who had betrayed him.
May you be in heaven half an hour before the devil knows you're dead, he said.
It was all stumbles and swirls after that. Singing and dancing, something about abbots and friars, about the men in the stained glass being apostles, slices of succulent pork slid onto plates, much wine, more singing, more young women, inebriated, willing. A moment to himself, thoughts about McLachlan, guilt about McLachlan, confusion about under Jennifer. Then someone shook him out of it, back to the revelry. You're the top, you're the breasts on Venus, you're the top, you're King Kong's penis. Dulles and Dulles and Sam the Banana Man and Cone and Strongfellow and LaMontagne and that red-headed waitress Susanna on his lap. And a whirlpool of images, blurry, hard to understand as if he were underwater, stumbling onto the street, falling, laughing, getting up. Then blackness. Charlie awoke hours later, his head pounding, his face in the mud. Next to him lay a shiny black 1953 Studebaker Commander Starliner, partly submerged in Rock Creek. Chapter 15.
Friday, March 5th, 1954. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Margaret slept restlessly that night, tossing fitfully until the sound of a car door slamming brought her fully awake. She turned on the lamp on her night table, reached for the clock by her bed, and drew it to her heavy-lidded eyes. 5:33 a.m. In a state of sorrow, she'd gone to bed as soon as Charlie left last night. She couldn't imagine what the night was like for Henrietta McLachlan and her four children, the oldest only 14 years old. And she was sorely disappointed in Charlie. How could he just head back into the night on the heels of such awful news? She realized that things got done in D.C. only because of who you knew and whose back you scratched, and she'd tried to be understanding about Charlie's frequent nights out. But if this was going to be their new way of life, she wasn't sure how long she would last. These troubled thoughts kept deep sleep at bay, and she had hovered unsatisfyingly between awareness and oblivion. It had been almost worse than if she had stayed up all night. Echoes of the turning tumblers of the lock on the front door bounced up two flights of stairs to the bedroom. The deliberate movements of someone trying to be quiet and the sudden sharp sounds of that same someone having difficulty doing it. She heard the creaks from the floorboards as Charlie crept carefully upstairs and then slowly opened the door to their bedroom. Margaret lay on her side, facing the door, her eyes narrow slits. In his left hand, Charlie held his shoes, and Margaret felt a surge of exasperation at his faux consideration at 5:30 in the morning. He tiptoed into their bathroom and reemerged in pajamas, then eased himself into bed as quickly as he could. One didn't need Charlie's superhuman sense of smell to detect the excess alcohol oozing from every pore, a sudden punch of stink that was not unlike approaching the Saucony Mobile Oil Refinery on the brand-new New Jersey Turnpike. He sighed dramatically, an expression of weariness or worry Margaret couldn't tell. Then he cleared his throat, seemingly testing to see if she was awake. She stayed still.
"Margaret,"
he whispered. She didn't know how to react. She was angry, and he reeked, and she didn't want to deal with him and whatever piffle was troubling him. She lay there silently, wondering what was happening to him and to them. Beyond how let down she felt about Charlie's behavior last night and the mess he was this morning, Margaret had something to tell him, and she knew it wasn't going to help matters. For whatever reason, perhaps the folly of holding on to a shred of power by maintaining control of this information, she had decided not to tell him the night before. Louis Gwinnett had telephoned the previous afternoon before Charlie came home from work. He and his team were out at Nanticoke and Susquehannock Islands again, and a researcher had dropped out at the last minute because of a death in the family. "We really could use you if you're willing," he had said. Margaret hadn't responded. "Think of the ponies, Margaret. This is the time when they swim from Nanticoke to Susquehannock. Now, any minute now."
"It's tempting."
"You're actually going to make me beg," Gwinnett said, and Margaret could practically hear his smile. She was surprised that her heart had begun beating a little faster at the sound of his voice. They had not spoken in 2 months, since January. He had written her a glowing letter about her work on the previous expedition, one that walked right up to the line of inappropriate but did not cross it. They had communicated in letters about how to write up the research from their days in the field, but she kept everything professional. But all the while, she and Charlie were drifting, with forces pushing Charlie out to sea while she remained alone on the beach, each watching the other recede into the distance and neither doing much about it. And then, Dr. Louis Gwinnett had reared his head once again. Margaret was secure enough in her emotional stability and her self-control, particularly in her current pregnant state, to trust that she would not say yes just because of her attraction to him. What pulled her most was the memory of how alive she felt in the field. It wasn't that she was unhappy in her Georgetown home, or even more generally in stuffy Washington, D.C., though that surely played a part. But the sudden transition from their old life in New York to one here in which Charlie pursued a new career while she waited for their baby to arrive had made her feel as though she'd gone from being a scientist to being a laboratory. She'd let a moment pass before she answered Gwinnett.
"I'd love to be there," Margaret had finally told him. "I just need to check on a few things."
Those few things were all contained in one drunken husband who was now lightly snoring beside her. It wasn't a hard decision. Margaret got up and prepared to phone the research assistant, who Gwinnett had said would give her a ride. As soon as the clock struck 7, she would call him and arrange to leave for the Maryland Islands as soon as possible.
The phone woke Charlie at 10 a.m. He was used to Margaret answering when someone called, but by the seventh ring he realized she wasn't going to do so. His head was throbbing, and the inside of his mouth tasted even worse than when he'd woken up with it full of mud just hours before. His tongue felt as if it were coated with a paste made of absinthe and bile and cheap perfume. The phone ringing exacerbated the pounding in his skull, so he mustered the strength to roll over and reach for the phone on the night table on Margaret's side of the bed.
"Hello," he croaked.
"Congressman, it's Catherine Leopold. Where are you? You have a very busy day today."
Gripping his forehead as if pressure would make the pain go away, Charlie apologized and promised he'd be in as soon as possible. He hung up, and then everything from the night before hit him like a wave. McLachlan's death, the drunken party at the club, Rock Creek, the dead girl. Good Lord, the dead girl. That gorgeous young redhead, what was her name? Oh, Christ, what have I done? He sat frozen for 1 minute, then five. The phone rang again, and he ignored all eight rings. Finally, as if on autopilot, he stood unsteadily and began to fumble his way to the bathroom. He tripped over the box containing the baby monitor, the gift from La Montaigne a lifetime ago. Charlie shaved and brushed his teeth. In a fog of sleep deprivation, booze, and trauma, he stepped into the steam of the shower. The memories of the night before came back to him in glimpses. Puzzle pieces he was in no condition to assemble. He didn't remember leaving the Mayflower. All was black until he awoke face down in the muck of Rock Creek. La Montaigne had arrived and attempted to whisk him away until he'd found the dead girl. Charlie had scurried to her side to try and find any signs of life. La Montaigne had then barked at him to help him carry her to the crashed Studebaker.
"No," Charlie said.
"What?"
"I said no. I'm not going to carry her to the car."
La Montaigne had bent down and grabbed Charlie by the shoulders.
"Listen to me, you little shit. If you don't do exactly as I say, your child will never see you anywhere other than inside a cell. Margaret will leave you and marry another man. You are throwing everything away. For what? For fucking what?"
"It's wrong," Charlie had said. Off in the distance, they could hear another car. La Montaigne let go of Charlie, bent down, scooped up the young woman, and carried her to the Studebaker on his own. He wedged her into the driver's seat. "Come over here and help me set the Studebaker on fire, Charlie."
"No," Charlie said. "Help me set the fucking Studebaker on fire."
"Go to hell, Davis."
"You fucking idiot,"
La Montaigne said. He unscrewed the gas cap, took some papers from his pocket, and ignited the ends with a lighter. Then he delicately inserted the roll into the gas tank opening and ran up the bank to Charlie on the road.
"Get in the car," he ordered.
And this time Charlie obeyed. La Montaigne turned the key of his Dodge Fire Arrow and floored the pedal, and they sped off. Charlie replayed this as he stood in the shower, groaning and rubbing his face. He slowly toweled himself off and dressed, every movement requiring extra effort. Adjusting his thin, blue Brooks Brothers tie, Charlie made his way downstairs, preparing an answer for the questions Margaret would surely have about his late night. The kitchen was empty.
"Margaret?"
No response. He moved through the house, looping in his cufflinks, and peered into the living room. Also empty. Had she had something to do this morning that she'd told him about and he'd forgotten? He looked on the kitchen table for a note and found none. The seed of a new anxiety began to take root in his stomach. Looking outside, wondering where his wife was, he saw dark clouds gathering, and as he made a mental note to bring an umbrella, he realized he wasn't sure where his car was. The last place he remembered seeing it was with the valet at the Mayflower Hotel. One more loose end, but a trifle comparatively. Charlie called for a taxi, then sat down heavily at the kitchen table, head in hands. Outside, a growl of thunder sounded ominously close. Inside, the house felt unnaturally quiet without Margaret there. He still could not believe his memories of the night before. Initially, he thought the flashes of heat he felt had something to do with the approaching thunderstorm. Beads of sweat began collecting on Charlie's forehead, the nape of his neck, the small of his back. He shivered, then stood and raced to the sink, where his abdominal muscles and diaphragm contracted, emptying everything out of his stomach, splashing the coffee cup Margaret had used at breakfast. Hyperventilating, he steeled himself for a second spasm and retched again. He fell to his knees, continuing to hold the rim of the sink. He hung there for a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, as he slowed his breathing.
Okay. Focus.
He stared at the yellow linoleum and tried to steady himself. Sheets of rain began hitting the street outside, sounding like an enthusiastic round of applause. Individual drops planked hard on the window panes like sniper's bullets. Charlie stood up slowly and reached for the kitchen telephone on the wall. He asked the operator to connect him to Winston Martyr on 72nd Street in Manhattan and gave her the number.
Connecting.
A minute or so later, Charlie heard Winston's booming baritone, loud enough to make him wince a bit, and pull the receiver away from his ear.
Charles, how are you, my son?
Not well, Dad.
Is Margaret all right, the baby?
They're both fine. It's not that.
What is it?
Are you alone? Charlie asked.
I am, as far as I know,
Winston said dryly.
One can never be certain.
Charlie was tempted to tell his father this was no time for philosophical cutesiness, but he stopped when he recalled that in a recent letter, his father had speculated that J. Edgar Hoover was tapping phones all over Manhattan and Washington without bothering with the nuisance of lawfully obtained warrants.
I was just reading a fascinating story about J. Edgar Hoover and the magnificent job the FBI is doing these days to root out the communist menace,
his father said, confirming Charlie's suspicions.
I would love to talk to you about it, and your mother would love to see you and Margaret this weekend, and if not this weekend, then sometime soon. Congress is breaking for recess next week, isn't it?
I'll talk about it with her, Charlie said. It would be great to see you and catch up.
That sounds like a plan,
Winston replied. Charlie hung up. With his father wary of speaking on the phone and Margaret AWOL, he had no one to talk to, no way to unburden himself. Not that he was sure he'd be able to divulge every detail about the previous night to his wife or father either. Washing his face at the kitchen sink, he heard the honk of a car horn. The cab. He ran through the rain and had the driver take him to the Mayflower. After Margaret left her townhouse that morning, she visited the Birder Emporium, a shop tucked into Waters Alley off the very busy Wisconsin Avenue. A large tabby cat curled up near a heating vent meowed, then returned to its nap. The store sold anything a birdwatcher would ever need. Bookshelves of field guides organized by state, country, and continent. Warm clothing and hiking shoes. Insect repellent, chairs, blankets, thermoses, pocket knives, camping equipment, backpacks, and lanterns. The walls were lined with photographs of a couple on various excursions through the decades, interspersed with posters of John James Audubon's paintings of rare birds, Atwater's Greater Prairie Chicken, Kirtland's Warbler, the San Clemente Loggerhead's Shrike. The owners, Sidney and Bernice Greenstein, emerged from the back of the store to welcome Margaret as warmly as if she were a guest they'd been expecting for lunch. They'd aged considerably since the last photograph had been taken, Margaret could see, but they were lively and cheerful. She told them the purpose of her visit and about her upcoming trip to research the ponies, her need for a new pair of binoculars to replace the ones she'd dropped into the marsh on Nanticoke Island. Sidney Greenstein led Margaret to a file cabinet in the corner of the store and, with painstaking precision, showed her the many options available. Margaret early on decided that a pair of Ross binoculars would suffice, but the old man seemed to be enjoying the opportunity to show off his expertise, so she patiently sat through the entire presentation. After its merciful conclusion, Bernice Greenstein reminded her husband that there was one box in the bottom drawer he hadn't brought out. "Why don't you show her that one as well, Sidney?" And so it was that Margaret emerged from the store with not only a new pair of Ross binoculars, but also a short-lived product from RCA, night vision binoculars, built using guided missile technology, but discontinued after consumers found them too expensive and too heavy. Eager to unload them, the Greensteins had offered Margaret a substantial discount, and Margaret was excited to show off the new toy to Gwinnett and the other researchers. Under darkening, cloud-heavy skies, she made her way home through the rain, happily burdened by her new acquisitions, less happily by thoughts of Charlie. She knew he would not be pleased about this sudden trip. She would tell him as soon as possible, either in person if he was still at the house nursing his hangover, or on the phone. As she walked, she prepared some rational counterarguments to any objections he might make. But Charlie wasn't home. Margaret phoned and found he was not yet at work. So she dashed off a quick note, collected her suitcase and coat, and called her ride to tell him that she was ready. As she waited, she fretted about Charlie. She didn't know what was motivating him anymore.